Welcome to Energy Stew. This is Peter Roth, your host, and we're going to talk about the cosmos again. I love to talk about that. And the holographic nature of the cosmos with an author who was on the show, I believe, a week ago. And fortunately, she came back to talk more with us. She's the author of The Cosmic Hologram, Information at the Center of Creation. Wow, that's something. So let's welcome Jude Kuravan. Jude, welcome back to Energy Stew.
Peter, it's great to be back with you guys. Thank you again for inviting me.
Oh, I'm so glad, because you can never stop talking about the universe and nature and our reality and consciousness and intelligence, and it goes on and on.
And on.
And so I thought we could start off just talking about the fact that science isn't so known as people think. There's so much that we are still learning, and we understand a lot, but there's also a lot of room for opinions and differences, and depends a lot on our own consciousness and our willingness to explore and understand things in new and different ways, right?
Absolutely. You know, at the end of the day, scientists are people too, and there's a lot of evidence that shows that there is an unintentional bias, but the one thing that, you know, that we all bring to our perception of what we call reality. But I guess that it's most fundamental and most importantly, science is a methodology of process, a methodology of evidence. So it's not about, you know, alternative facts. It's about the facts, the evidence. But as you say, there is a great deal still unknown. I think though we're living in an amazingly interesting and important moment where, you know, recent discoveries, rather like they did 100 years ago with the 20th century scientific revolution, are literally throwing everything up in the air. And what is emerging is a radical new perspective of the nature of reality that is being discovered as scientific evidence, but crucially reconciles with universal spiritual experiences. You know, we've had this sort of separation and almost a schism between a scientific perspective of the world and a felt, experienced, conscious perspective of the world. And, you know, for me, there've always been a false schism. And now we're finding that science and scientific discoveries are coming back to a reconciliation with an experienced and ultimately conscious perspective of the nature of reality.
Well, that goes back historically, because centuries ago, people like Galileo were told that the church has to do with our souls, and science has to stay away from that totally. If not, they'd go to jail or be killed.
Or worse, absolutely.
Tortured, right, yes. So the scientists built a meme, just a deep understanding that they can't touch anything ephemeral. You know, it has to really be grounded in hard science that is touchable. And so I think a lot of it is based on that schism, and coming forward, we're now finally, you know, some scientists have tried, and some have still been slaughtered by it. Rupert Sheldrake mm-hmm. has been really hammered for his new understandings of reality. And it's interesting to watch. And there was a book out recently about that, about how science still wants to be stuck. And they don't really accept new concepts.
It's a very interesting perspective of human awareness, isn't it, Peter? Because you're right. I mean, Galileo, I always remember the story of Galileo, of course, you know, invented the first telescope and discovered as a result the four main moons, the larger moons of Jupiter. And the priests of the time, the Catholic priests at the time, refused to look up the telescope. And in a funny way, there are scientists now that won't look up the telescope of this new understanding and this new reconciliation of science and consciousness. And I think you're absolutely right. You know, that very sensible separation of science and religion back in sort of the time of Galileo and Newton, you know, was able to save scientists from awful fates. But it became, as we both, I think, view it as, a schism that really hasn't helped the world. And now, as we are on the threshold, I believe, of reconciling those two perspectives, it's not about religion. It is about bringing the understanding of consciousness into the center of our explorations of the nature of reality, because we got a lot of clues, didn't we, back 100 years ago with quantum theory and relativity theory, that all was not what it appeared on the surface, you know, that physicality is far more ephemeral than we think it is, that whenever we observe or measure something, we realize it, that although within space-time, you know, the signaling of light is this cosmic speed limit, and so causality is preserved, nonetheless, our universe is non-locally connected, which means beyond those limits of space and time. So lots of clues, but I think the time in our psyche wasn't ready yet to allow that reconciliation that now I feel we are ready for, but more importantly, we have absolutely convincing evidence for, that information is reality and mind is matter and consciousness isn't something we have, it's what we and the whole world are. So I think there's lots of converging roads that have come to this destination, right, of this emergent understanding of unified reality.
I think a big question mark for a lot of people is, what does it mean by non-locality? And as you say, it supersedes time and space, because that has to do with locality. And and therefore, how do you get away from that? And then there are parts of the universe that are totally unexplored, like the dark matter of the universe. And who knows what that holds? And maybe that really is a magical environment if we could penetrate it better.
I think that's right. I mean, as you say, when we look at what we call physical reality, with all the points I made earlier, only about 4 or 5% is visible energy and matter. The rest is either dark, what we call dark matter, because it's not visible, and it only interacts with other matter and energy through gravity, and so-called dark energy, which seems to be a tension within the space-time fabric of our universe itself, and which, you know, Einstein called the cosmological constant. But that is not a settled, by any stretch, a settled understanding. But I think for me, that it could well be very magical. It could well be that both of those are actually understood in fairly standard terms. For me, what's absolutely crucial goes way beyond that, to this perspective that I write about in the book, and the evidence that's coming, you know, it's coming absolutely like an oncoming train, that information is as real as anything we call, you know, subatomic entities. They are incredibly will-o'-the-wisp. Information has been experimentally shown to be as physically real as anything else we call physical reality. But when you get that information is reality, then it's a slippery slope, and a wonderfully slippery slope, to this point that consciousness is everything that we are, that the world is, and plays itself out on many, many different levels of awareness and understanding, but that our universe exists and evolves as a coherent and unified entity within the infinity of the cosmos.
Many years ago, I was attracted to the writings of David Bohm, and his understanding of the holographic universe, and how form is information. But how does information reveal itself without consciousness?
I don't think it does. For me, they are aspects of the same whole. I mean, one of the analogies I've been sort of working with is the idea that, you know, if we see information as notes, musical notes, then consciousness is the music. You know, we build up music, beautiful music, whether it's a Beatles song or whether it's Bach or whatever it may be, from notes. So if we see information, and what we're talking about here is exactly the same digitized information that forms the basis of all our technologies, is the universal information that makes up and is the most fundamental stuff of reality. And yet we can look at information as those basic notes or those basic letters from which we create music, from which we create words, from which we create songs. So for me, information is the bedrock of which consciousness then plays the music, sings the songs, writes the sonnets.
Well, I think it's even more pervasive than that, because you know, we can think of information as digital, and that's based on codes. So when people are listening to music, for instance, through digital coding, it only really becomes music to their brains. Otherwise, it's just code.
Indeed.
And
indeed.
It's amazing
what I'm saying
how,
is.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. What you're saying is.
I'm agreeing with you that everything is consciousness, essentially. But
right.
What I talk about of information, it's information is like the basic bits of that consciousness. You know, when you and I speak, I'm speaking words, you're speaking words. Those words, you know, are being coded as digitized information and being squirted through cables between my computer and your computer and across the Atlantic. But what I'm saying is everything we call reality is digitized information, informed patterns, dynamic patterns that are consciousness at play on all holographic levels. So very, very similar to what David Bohm was saying. Now with, though, the experimental evidence on every scale and across pretty much every scientific field of research saying this same thing.
Right. Now, I'm looking out my window at a tree. Now, that's just information. That I'm looking at information because if it wasn't information that my mind doesn't see as a solid tree, it's not solid at all.
Exactly.
It's just a lot of electrons floating around and atoms and who knows what. I mean, it's space. I'm looking at space defining itself as mass because I'm the witness to it.
Exactly. And essentially the whole universe is a witness to itself on many,
yes,
many different levels, on holographic levels of realization.
Right. Perhaps even trees are witnesses to each other.
Oh, that's my next book.
Okay, good. I love that. I can't wait.
My next book's called Gaia Her Story, because it's the story of our beloved planetary home from the beginning of what I call the Big Breath, not the Big Bang, of 13.8 billion years ago, and how that information has existed and evolved to ever greater levels of complexity. And around 5 billion years ago, all the, if you like, the nutrients, all the building blocks of complexity and patterning, informational patterning, were ready to create rocky planets such as our Earth, able to harbor the emergence of biological life, which, as far as we have a sense of, is as yet the most complex arrangement, dynamic arrangement of microcosmic intelligence physically present in our universe.
Well, there needed to be an evolutionary purpose in order to create complexity and refinement to have such life purpose to it. And, you know, why do we exist? You know, why isn't space just a whole bunch of jumbled bits rather than forming all the beauty that it has formed?
Absolutely. And, you know, the book's subtitle is In Dash Formation, because it is that very exquisite, ordered information. It isn't just data. Nothing is random at all. It's not just data. It's informed patterns. And the laws of physics, if there's anybody who writes software listening to us, they talk about algorithms for software. And all algorithms are is instructions of how to create a piece of software. Essentially, the laws of physics are the algorithms for our universe, enabling it to both exist and, crucially, to evolve. And from the very first moment of our universe, in that first moment of the Big Breath, which was an exquisite out-breath, it wasn't a big bang. It was neither big, but it certainly wasn't a bang. It wasn't an explosion. It was amazingly ordered and exquisitely fine-tuned. To enable us, 13.8 billion years ago, to be having this conversation.
Right, and it keeps on growing.
It does.
I've been using algorithms to create more order of our organs and glands, and even our consciousness. There are algorithms, numerical sequences, that have been discovered. That and I've also channeled in some unusual algorithms to provide new information to our consciousness to help create more order for specific purposes. And so we can assist the universe and help it evolve through all the work that we're doing.
Absolutely. I mean, we are microcosmic co-creators of its innate intelligence, and we are all part of its ever evolving through a lifestyle. I mean, through a life cycle, because, you know, cosmologists now are coming more and more to the perspective that ours is a finite universe, literally a finite thought form in the infinite and eternal mind of the cosmos. So we are an intrinsic part of that thought form as our universe and we evolve and evolve to ever greater levels of coherence and complexity and levels of self-awareness.
And also multidimensional levels of soul. And that's something else that at some point science will recognize, because nothing can exist outside of science. It's just that's the nature of science, is just understanding information. And so if we live in a multidimensional universe with an afterlife and multiple lifetimes and all kinds of spiritual masters who we come into contact with, et cetera, people might scientists might not understand that because they don't have a science for it. But there is a science for it. We just don't know it yet.
I think that's absolutely right. And my own experiences from a very early age, about 4 years old, have been exploring such multidimensional realities. So absolutely, completely agree with you. But when we actually, this emergent understanding of the cosmic hologram and information as reality, mind as matter, and consciousness as the whole world, then the multidimensionality is a natural, an innate, crucial, integral part of all of that.
Once you can understand non-locality, accept non-locality, because, I mean, maybe there is locations in other dimensions, but not in the same way we can grasp that here. And so, we can, and when you work intuitively, I do that, I'm a professional intuitive, and I can receive information from the cosmos about things. I've worked with scientists, giving them information that they needed. And it's like, you know, one time I was with a scientist and the universe says, you have to tell him this. And I said, oh, leave me alone, you know. And finally I said to the scientist, I'm being told I have to tell you something. And I gave him some information that was coming through. And he said, oh, I've been waiting for that information for a long time. And it's like, and what do I know? You know, I'm not the scientist who understands it. I just told him what I was hearing. So how can we operate that way? You know, how can our brains know things that are not third dimensional, something that we've consciously stored into our brain but comes from other places? How do we understand how our brains operate non-locally like that?
I think it's innate. I mean, quantum theory actually can't work without universal non-locality. It's something called Bell's theorem. And last year, scientists, astronomers were able to validate Bell's theorem applying to at least interstellar scales. So there really is now a very strong perspective that our entire universe within space, what the construct, remember it's a construct of consciousness. And it's a construct of consciousness without which there will be no sense of a flow of time. The point of space-time is it allows our universe to evolve. Time flows forward. Space expands to allow ever greater levels of information to be experienced and explored and evolved within our universe. And yet, just as, you know, we evolve, and yet we are a human being. You know, we're born as a baby, we grow up, we eventually die. We evolve through that process and we embody ever greater levels of self-awareness. And yet our entire psyche is essentially a unified entity. And we could have an analogy where it is non-local of itself with its distributed intelligence. But what we realize is that the non-locality on a universal scale is crucial for our universe to be a coherent and unified entity, and yet within what we call space-time, and realizing that, you know, our brains, the matter of our brains is consciousness. It's not, you know, it's not, atoms are information. We don't, you know, we have to get beyond this idea that if we drill down somehow there's tiny little billiard balls of matter. Matter is information. Mind is matter. And so when we do that, we can literally bring together all of science. This understanding, you know, reconciles quantum relativity theory. It reconciles what we understand and experience within space-time as causality, and yet the non-locality of our universe. And it ultimately reconciles a scientific appreciation of reality with universal spiritual experiences, as you say, going back way, way before Galileo, was the sacred science of the ancients. And they had that deep intuitive knowingness and experiencing of the oneness of all
that
is.
Right, it's the experience. But I'm also thinking that the universe can't experience itself if it only was limited by space and time. So that's how Bell's theorem works, is that it can know itself non-locally in the most efficient way.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
So, yeah,
that non-local awareness, you know, that's exactly how it is. And, you know, we get glimpses of that at the moment through what we call supernormal phenomena like telepathy and intuitive knowing, remote viewing, etc. My sense is we're on the cusp of a shift of our own consciousness that will enable us to experience the extraordinary in the ordinary and the ordinary in the extraordinary of multidimensional realities, and yet still, you know, still know that we're human, but we are far, far more than that.
Yeah, I love that, and I agree. And we know that, for instance, right now, the Earth's energy is speeding up. The Schumann resonance is getting higher, and it never did that before. And our consciousness has to catch up with it. And so as our consciousness raises, and it has to now, we will become more aware. on yes. all these levels.
Yes.
And so, you know, the work that you do is fantastic, and I'm so excited that, you know, you keep on writing new books.
Thank you, Peter. I mean, this is the first book, The Cosmic Hologram, as I mentioned. It's the first book of what I'm calling the Transformation Trilogy. And it's the head, if you like, the understanding of this bigger picture. So the next book, Gaia Her Story, is the heart. And that's how do we fully heal our relationship with Gaia and our multidimensional brothers and sisters of our universe. And then the third book is Many Voices, One Heart, which is our hands. It's like now, you know, as we increase our level of awareness, as we come together to go through this next evolutionary leap, what does that mean for us? How do we transform, you know, our behaviors? How do we're like kids at the school gates, it seems to me. And it's like the first day of school. And when we can actually remember the oneness, really understand and experience and begin to embody unity awareness, my goodness me, those school gates are opening. And boy, are we for an adventure ahead.
I'm so excited to hear of your plans, and I can't wait to read your future books and have you back on Energy Stew. And, you know, this is so great talking with you. And the book that you have out now is The Cosmic Hologram, Information at the Center of Creation. And you are Jude Kurivan, Kurivan. How can people locate a website or find you?
The website is very simple. Thank you, Peter. It's www.judekurivan.com. If people go to Amazon or Barnes & Noble, they can get the book. And we're starting to sort of do more outreach now. So they can sign up for my regular newsletters by going to my website. I also have an email, judekurivan@gmail.com, on that website. So folks can get in touch with me. They can find about what I'm doing. And after sort of being in deep writing immersion for the book, there's now a big outreach to share its message of unified reality as widely as we possibly can.
This is so wonderful, Jude. Thanks so much. I love talking with you. I can't wait for the future opportunities ahead to talk about all of this with you. So thank you so much for being on Energy Stew.
Oh, bless you, Peter. Anytime, I'll be delighted to be on the show. And thank you for all that you do and for everyone who's listening to us.
Thank you. And this is Peter Roth, your host of Energy Stew at PRN.FM. I can be reached at peter@heartriver.org or 212-222-7748. I'd love to hear from you, and thanks so much for listening.